with a winky face. She was irritatingly fond of winky faces. Another day she had posted, "Really tough day today. Thank God for my amazing partner. Hashtag blessed." She posted one more picture of Sam at the wheel of the ambulance. He was laughing, lifting his hand up as if to stop her. And the sight of his face, the intimacy of the shot, the way it placed me in the cab with them, took my breath away. We had scheduled a call for the previous evening, his time, and when I'd called he hadn't picked up. I tried again, twice, with no answer. 2 hours later, just as I was getting worried, I received a text message. "Sorry, you still there?" "Are you okay? Was it work?" I said when he called me. There was the faintest hesitation before he responded, "Not exactly." "What do you mean?" I was in the car with Gary waiting, while Agnes had a pedicure, and I was conscious that he might be listening in, no matter how engrossed he appeared to be in the sports pages of the New York Post. "I was helping Katie with something." My stomach dropped merely at the mention of her name. "Helping her with what?" I tried to keep my voice light. "Just a wardrobe, IKEA. She bought it and couldn't put it together by herself, so I said I'd give her a hand." I felt sick. "You went to her house?" "Flat. It was just to help with a piece of furniture, Lou. She doesn't have anyone else. I only live down the road." "You took your toolbox." I remembered how he used to come to my flat and fix things. It had been one of the first things I'd loved about him. "Yes, I took my toolbox, and all I did was help her with an IKEA wardrobe." His voice had grown weary. "Sam?"
"What?"
"Did you offer to go there, or did she ask you?"
"Does it matter?"
I wanted to tell him it did, because it was obvious that she was trying to steal him from me. She was alternately playing the helpless female, the fun party girl, the understanding best friend and work colleague. He was either blind to it or, worse, he wasn't. There wasn't a single picture that she had posted online in which she wasn't glued to his side like some kind of lipsticked leech. Sometimes I wondered if she'd guessed I'd be looking at them, and if she got satisfaction from knowing the discomfort this caused me. Whether in fact this was part of her plan, to make me miserable and paranoid. I wasn't sure men would ever understand the infinitely subtle weaponry women used against each other. The silence between us on the phone opened up and became a sinkhole. I knew I couldn't win. If I tried to warn him about what was happening, I became a jealous harpy. If I didn't, he'd carry on walking blindly into her man-trap, until the day he suddenly realized he was missing her as much as he had ever missed me. Or he found her soft hand creeping into his at the pub, and she leant on him for comfort after a tough day. Or they bonded over some shared adrenaline rush, some near-death incident, and found themselves kissing, and... I closed my eyes. "So when do you get back?"
"Christmas Eve."
"Great. I'll try and move some shifts. I'll be working for some of the Christmas period, though, Lou. You know the job. It doesn't stop." He sighed. There was a pause before he spoke again.
"Listen, I was thinking, maybe it would be a good idea if you and Katie met each other. Then you can see she's okay. She's not trying to be anything other than a mate."
"Like hell she isn't."
"Great! Sounds lovely," I said.
"I think you'll like her."
"Then I'm sure I will."
"Like I'd like Ebola virus or grating off my own elbows, or maybe eating that cheese that has live bugs in it."
He sounded relieved when he said,
"Can't wait to see you. You're back for a week, right?"
I lowered my head, trying to muffle my voice a little.
"Sam, does Katie really want to meet me? Is this, like, something you've discussed?"
"Yeah." And then when I said nothing, he added,
"I mean, not in any... We didn't talk about what happened with you and me or anything. But she gets that it must be hard for us."
"I see." I felt my jaw tighten.
"She thinks you sound great. Obviously I told her she got that wrong."
I laughed, and I'm not sure the world's worst actor could have made it sound less convincing.
"You'll see when you meet her. Can't wait."
When he rang off, I looked up to find Gary was looking at me in the rearview mirror. Our eyes met for a moment, then his slid away. Given that I lived in one of the world's busiest metropolises, I'd begun to understand that the world as I knew it was actually very small, shrink-wrapped around the demands of the Gopniks, from 6 in the morning, often until late evening. My life had become completely intertwined with theirs. Just as I had with Will, I'd become attuned to Agnes's every mood, able to detect from the subtlest signs whether she was depressed, angry, or simply in need of food. I now knew when her periods were due, and marked them in my personal diary so that I could be braced for 5 days of heightened emotion or extra emphatic piano playing. I knew how to become invisible during times of family conflict, or when to be ever-present. I became a shadow, so much so that sometimes I felt almost evanescent, useful only in relation to someone else. My life before the Gopniks had receded, become a faint, ghostly thing, experienced through odd phone calls, when Gopnik schedules allowed, or sporadic emails. I failed to ring my sister for 2 weeks and cried when my mother sent me a handwritten letter with photographs of her and Tom at the theatre matinee, just in case she'd forgotten what we looked like. It could get a little much. So was a balance, even though I was exhausted. I travelled to the library every weekend with Ashok and Mina, once even going by myself when their children were ill. I got better at dressing for the cold, and made my own placard, "Knowledge is Power," with its private nod to Will. I would head back on the train and afterwards make my way down to the East Village to have a coffee at the Vintage Clothes Emporium, and look over whatever new items Lydia and her sister had in stock. Mr. Gopnik never mentioned the library again. I realised with mild disappointment that charity could mean something quite different here, that it was not enough to give, you had to be seen to be giving. Hospitals bore the names of their donors in 6-foot-high letters above the door. Balls were named after those who funded them. Even buses bore lists of names alongside their rear windows. Mr. and Mrs. Leonard Gopnik were known as generous benefactors, because they were visible in society as being so. A scruffy library in a run-down neighbourhood offered no such kudos. Ashok and Mina had invited me for Thanksgiving at their apartment in Washington Heights, horrified when I revealed I had no plans. "You can't spend Thanksgiving on your own," Ashok said, and I decided not to mention that few people in England even knew what it was. "My mother makes the turkey, but don't expect it to be done American style," Mina said. "We can't stand all that bland food. This is going to be some serious tandoori turkey." It was no effort to say yes to something new. I was quite excited. I bought a bottle of champagne, some fancy chocolates, and some flowers for Mina's mother, then put on my blue cocktail dress with the fur sleeves, figuring an Indian Thanksgiving would be a suitable first outing for it, or at least one with no discernible dress code. Ilaria was flat out preparing for the Gopniks' family dinner, and I decided not to disturb her. I let myself out, checking that I had the instructions Ashok had given me. As I headed down the corridor, I noticed Mrs. DeWitt's door was open. I heard the television burbling from deep inside the apartment. A few feet from the door, Dean Martin stood in the hallway glaring at me. I wondered if he was about to make another break for freedom, and rang the doorbell. Mrs. DeWitt emerged into the corridor. "Mrs. DeWitt, I think Dean Martin may be about to go for a walk." The dog pottered back towards her. She leaned against the wall. She looked frail and tired.
"Can you shut the door, dear? I must not have closed it properly."
"Will do. Happy Thanksgiving, Mrs. DeWitt," I said.
"Is it? I hadn't noticed."
She disappeared back into the room, the dog behind her, and I closed the front door. I had never seen her with so much as a casual caller, and felt a brief sadness at the thought of her spending Thanksgiving alone. I was just turning to leave when Agnes came down the corridor in her gym kit. She seemed startled to see me.
"Where are you going?"
"To dinner." I didn't want to say who I was going with. I didn't know how the employees of the building would feel if they thought the staff were getting together without them. She looked at me in horror.
"But you can't go, Louisa. Leonard's family is coming here. I can't do this by myself. I told them you would be here."
"You did? But..."
"You must stay."
I looked at the door. My heart sank. And then her voice dropped.
"Please, Louisa. You are my friend. I need you."
I rang Ashok and told him. My one consolation was that doing the job he did, he grasped the situation immediately. "I'm so sorry," I whispered into the phone. "I really wanted to come."
"Nah, you gotta stay. Hey, Mina's yelling to tell you she's gonna save some turkey for you. I'll bring it with me tomorrow."
"Baby, I told her."
"I did."
"She says drink all their expensive wine, okay?"
I felt briefly on the edge of tears. I had looked forward to an evening full of giggling children, delicious food and laughter. Instead, I was going to be a shadow again, a silent prop in an icy room. My fears were justified. Three other members of the Gopnik family came to Thanksgiving. His brother, an older, greyer, more anemic version of Mr. Gopnik, who apparently did something in law, probably round the US Department of Justice. He brought with him their mother, who sat in a wheelchair, refused to take off her fur coat for the entire evening, and complained loudly that she couldn't hear what anyone was saying. Mr. Gopnik's brother's wife, a former violinist apparently of some note, accompanied them. She was the only person there who bothered to ask what I did. She greeted Agnes with two kisses, and the kind of professional smile that could have been meant for anyone. Tab made up the numbers, arriving late and bringing with her the air of someone who has spent their cab ride in deep telephone discussion about how much they did not want to be there. Moments after she got there, we were seated to eat in the dining room, which was off the main living room and dominated by a long, oval, mahogany dining table. It is fair to say the conversation was stilted. Mr. Gopnik and his brother fell immediately into conversation about the legal restrictions in the country where he was currently doing business, and the two wives asked each other a few stiff questions, like people practicing small talk in a foreign language.
"How have you been, Agnes?"
"Fine, thank you. And you, Veronica?"
"Very well. You look very well. That's a very nice dress."
"Thank you. You also look very nice."
"Did I hear that you had been to Poland? I'm sure Leonard said you were visiting your mother."
"I was there 2 weeks ago. It was lovely to see her. Thank you."
I sat between Tab and Agnes, watching Agnes drink too much white wine and Tab flick mutinously through her phone and occasionally roll her eyes. I sipped at the pumpkin and sage soup, nodded, smiled, and tried not to think longingly of Ashok's apartment and the joyful chaos there. I would have asked Tab about her week, anything to move the stuttering conversation along, but she had made so many acids aside about the horror of having staff at family events that I didn't have the nerve. Ilaria brought out dish after dish.
"The Polish puta does not cook, so somebody has to give up their Thanksgiving," she muttered afterwards.
She had laid on a feast of turkey, roast potatoes, and a bunch of things I had never seen served as an accompaniment, but suspected they were about to leave me with instantaneous type 2 diabetes. Candied sweet potato casserole with marshmallow topping, green beans with honey and bacon, roasted acorn squash with bacon drizzled in maple syrup, buttery cornbread and carrots roasted with honey and spice. There were also popovers, a kind of Yorkshire pudding, and I peered at them surreptitiously to see if they were draped with syrup too. Of course, only the men ate much of it. Tab pushed hers around her plate. Agnes ate some turkey and almost nothing else. I had a little of everything, grateful for something to do, and also that Ilaria no longer slammed dishes down in front of me. In fact, she looked at me sideways a few times, as if to express silent sympathy for my predicament. The men kept talking business, unaware or unwilling to acknowledge the permafrost at the other end of the table. Occasionally the silence was broken by the elderly Mrs. Gopnik demanding somebody help her to some potato or asking loudly for the fourth time what on earth the woman had done to the carrots. Several people would answer her at once as if relieved to have a focus, no matter how irrational.
"That's an unusual dress, Louisa," said Veronica after a particularly long silence. "Very striking. Did you buy it in Manhattan? One doesn't often see fur sleeves these days."
"Thank you, I bought it in the East Village."
"Is it Marc Jacobs?"
"No, it's vintage."
"Vintage," snorted Tab.
"What did she say?"
said Mrs. Gopnik loudly.
"She's talking about the girl's dress, Mother," said Mr. Gopnik's brother. "She says it's vintage."
"Vintage what?"
"What is problem with a vintage, Tab?"
said Agnes coolly. I shrank backwards into my seat.
"It's such a meaningless term, isn't it? It's just a way of saying second-hand, a way of dressing something up to pretend it's something it's not."
I wanted to tell her that vintage meant a whole lot more than that, but I didn't know how to express it, and suspected I wasn't meant to. I just wanted the whole conversation to move forwards and away from me.
"I believe vintage outfits can be quite the fashion now," said Veronica, addressing me directly with a diplomat's skill.
"Of course, I'm far too old to understand the young people's trends these days."
"And far too polite to say such things," muttered Agnes.
"I'm sorry,"
said Tab.
Oh, now you are sorry.
I meant, what did you just say? Mr. Gopnik looked up from his plate. His eyes darted warily from his wife to his daughter.
I mean, why you have to be so rude to Louisa? She is my guest here, even if she is staff. And you have to be rude about her outfit.
I wasn't being rude. I was simply stating a fact.
This is how being rude is these days. I tell it like I see it. I'm just being honest. The language of the bully. We all know how this is.
What did you just call me? Agnes, darling. Mr. Gopnik reached across and placed his hand over hers.
What are they saying? Said Mrs. Gopnik. Tell them to speak up.
I said Tab is being very rude to my friend.
She's not your friend, for crying out loud. She's your paid assistant. Although I suspect that's all you can get in the way of friends these days.
Tab,
her father said.
That's a horrible thing to say.
Well, it's true. Nobody wants anything to do with her. You can't pretend you don't see it wherever we go. You know this family is a laughingstock, Daddy. You have become a cliché. She is a walking cliché. And for what? We all know what her plan is.
Agnes removed her napkin from her lap and screwed it into a ball.
My plan? You want to tell me what my plan is?
Like every other sharp-elbowed immigrant on the make, you've somehow managed to convince Dad to marry you. Now you're no doubt doing everything possible to get pregnant and pop out a baby or two. Then within 5 years you'll divorce him, and you're made for life. Boom. No more massages. Just Bergdorf Goodman, a driver and lunch with your Polish coven, all the way.
Mr. Gopnik leant forward over the table.
Tabitha, I don't want you ever using the word immigrant in a derogatory manner in this house again. Your great-grandparents were immigrants. You are the descendant of immigrants.
Not that kind of immigrant.
What does this mean?
Said Agnes, her cheeks flushed.
Do I have to spell it out? There are those who achieve their goals through hard work, and there are those who do it lying on their...
Like you! Yelled Agnes. Like you who lives off trust fund allowance at age of nearly 25. You who have barely held a job in your life. I am meant to take example from you. At least I know what hard work is.
Yes. Straddling strange men's naked bodies. Quite the employment.
That's enough.
Mr. Gopnik was on his feet. You are quite, quite wrong, Tabitha, and you must apologize.
Why?
Because I can see her without rose-colored spectacles. Daddy, I'm sorry to say this, but you are totally blind to what this woman really is.
No, you are the one who is wrong.
So she's never going to want children. She's 28 years old, Dad. Wake up.
What are they talking about?
Said old Mrs. Gopnik querulously to her daughter-in-law. Veronica whispered something in her ear.
But she said something about naked men. I heard her.
Not that it's any of your business, Tabitha, but there will be no more children in this house. Agnes and I agreed this point before I married her.
Tab pulled a face.
Oh, she agreed. Like that means anything at all. A woman like her would say anything to marry you.
Daddy, I hate to say it, but you are being hopelessly naive. In a year or so, there will be some little accident, and she'll persuade...
There will be no accidents! Mr. Gopnik slammed his hand on the table so hard the glassware rattled.
How can you know?
Because I had a goddamn vasectomy!
Mr. Gopnik sat down. His hands were shaking.
2 months before we got married. At Mount Sinai. With Agnes's full agreement. Are you satisfied now?
The room fell silent. Tab gaped at her father. The old woman looked from left to right, and then peering at Mr. Gopnik.
Leonard had an appendectomy?
A low hum had started somewhere in the back of my head, as if in the distance I heard Mr. Gopnik insisting that his daughter apologize, then watched her push back her chair and leave the table without doing so. I saw Veronica exchange looks with her husband and take a long, weary swig of her drink. And then I looked at Agnes, who was staring mutely at her plate on which her food was congealing in honeyed, bacon-strewn portions. As Mr. Gopnik reached out a hand and squeezed hers, my heart thumped loudly in my ears. She didn't look at me.
Chapter 17 I flew home on 22nd December, laden with presents and wearing my new vintage zebra print coat, which I would later discover was strangely and adversely affected by the circulation of recycled air in the 767 and smelt, by the time I reached Heathrow, like a deceased equid. I had actually not been due to fly until Christmas Eve, but Agnes had insisted I go sooner, as she was making an unheralded short stop back to Poland to see her mother, who was unwell, and there was apparently no point in my staying there to do nothing when I could be with my family. Mr. Gopnik had paid for the change to my ticket. Agnes had been both overly nice and distant with me since the Thanksgiving dinner. In turn, I was professional and amenable. Sometimes my head would spin with the information it had, but I would think of Gary's words way back in the autumn when I'd arrived. See nothing, hear nothing, forget everything. Something had happened in the run-up to Christmas, some lightening of my mood. Perhaps I was just relieved to be leaving that house of dysfunction. Or perhaps the act of buying Christmas presents had resurrected some buried sense of fun in my relationship with Sam. When had I last had a man to buy Christmas presents for, after all? For the last 2 years of our relationship, Patrick had simply sent me emails with links to specific pieces of fitness equipment he wanted. Don't bother wrapping them, babe, in case you get it wrong and I need to send them back. All I had done was press a button. I had never spent Christmas with Will. Now I went shoulder to shoulder with the other shoppers in Saks, trying to imagine my boyfriend in the cashmere sweaters, my face pressed against them, the soft checked shirts he liked to wear in the garden, thick outdoor socks from REI. I bought toys for Tom, getting a sugar high from the scents in the M&M store in Times Square. I bought stationery for Trina from McNally Jackson, and a beautiful dressing gown for Grandad from Macy's. Feeling flush, as I had spent so little over the past months, I bought Mum a little bracelet from Tiffany, and a wind-up radio for Dad to use in his shed. And then, as an afterthought, I bought a stocking for Sam. I filled it with small gifts, aftershave, novelty gum, socks and a beer holder in the shape of a woman in denim hot pants. Finally, I went back to the toy store where I had bought Tom's presents and bought a few pieces of Doll's House furniture, a bed, a table and chairs, a sofa and bathroom suite. I wrapped them and wrote on the label, "Until the real one is finished." I found a tiny medical kit and included that too, marvelling at the detail contained within it. And suddenly, Christmas felt real and exciting, and the prospect of almost 10 days away from the Gopniks in the city felt like a gift in itself. I arrived at the airport, praying silently that the weight of my gifts hadn't pushed me over the limit. The woman at check-in took my passport and asked me to lift my suitcase onto the scales, and frowned as she looked at the screen. "Is there a problem?" I said when she glanced at my passport, then behind her. I mentally calculated how much I might have to pay for the added weight. "Oh, no, ma'am, you shouldn't be in this queue." "You're kidding." My heart sank as I looked over at the heaving queues behind me. "Well, where should I be?"
"You're in business class."
"Business?"
"Yes, ma'am, you've been upgraded. You should be checking in over there. But it's no problem, I can do it for you here."
I shook my head. "Oh, I don't think so. I..." And then my phone dinged. I looked down.
"You should be at the airport by now. Hope this makes your journey home a bit more pleasant. Little gift from Agnes. See you in the new year, comrade. Michael. Kiss."
I blinked. "That's fine. Thank you." I watched my oversized suitcase disappear down the conveyor belt and put my phone back into my bag. The airport had been heaving, but in the business class section of the plane, everything was calm and peaceful, a little oasis of collective smugness removed from the holiday-related chaos outside. On board, I investigated my wash bag of complimentary overnight goodies, pulled on my free socks, and tried not to talk too much to the man in the next seat who eventually put his eye mask on and lay back. I had just one hiccup with the reclining seat when my shoe got caught in the footrest, but the steward was perfectly lovely and showed me how to get it out. I ate duck in a sherry glaze and lemon tart, and thanked all the staff who brought me things. I watched two films and realised I should really try to sleep for a bit, but it was hard when the whole experience was so delightful. It was exactly the kind of thing I would have written home about, except, I thought with butterflies in my stomach, now I was going to get to tell everyone in person. I was returning home a different Louisa Clark. That was what Sam had said, and I had decided to believe it. I was more confident, more professional, a long way from the sad, conflicted, physically broken person of 6 months ago. I thought about Sam's face when I would surprise him, just as he had surprised me. He had sent me a copy of his rota for the next fortnight, so that I could plan my visits to my parents, and I had calculated that I could drop my belongings at the flat, grab a few hours with my sister, then head over to his, and be there to meet him for the end of his shift. This time, I thought, we would get it right. We had a decent length of time to spend together, and this time, we would settle into some kind of routine, a way of existing with no trauma or misunderstandings. The first 3 months were always going to be the hardest. I pulled my blanket over me, and, already too far over the Atlantic for it to be of use, tried and failed to sleep. My stomach tight and my mind buzzing as I watched the tiny winking plane slide its way slowly across my pixelated screen. I arrived at my flat shortly after lunchtime and let myself in, fumbling with my keys. Trina was at work, Tom was still at school, and London's grey was punctured by glitter. Christmas lights and the sound of shops playing Christmas carols I'd heard a million times before. I walked up the stairs of my old building, breathing in the familiar scent of cheap air freshener and London damp, then opened my front door, dropped my suitcase the few inches to the floor, and let out a breath. Home. Or something like it. I walked down the hall, shedding my jacket, and let myself into the living room. I had been a little afraid of returning here, remembering the months in which I had been sunk in depression, drinking too much. Its empty, unloved rooms a self-inflicted rebuke for my failure to save the man who had given it to me. But this, I grasped immediately, was not the same flat. In 3 months it had been utterly transformed. The once bare interior was now full of colour, paintings by Tom pinned to every wall. There were embroidered cushions on the sofa, and a new upholstered chair and curtains, and a shelf bursting with DVDs. The kitchen was crammed with food packets and new crockery. A cereal bowl and Cocoa Pops on a rainbow placemat spoke of a hurriedly abandoned breakfast. I opened the door to my spare room, now Tom's, smiling at the football posters and cartoon-printed duvet. A new wardrobe was stuffed with his clothes. Then I walked to my bedroom, now Trina's, and found a rumpled quilt, a new bookshelf and blind. Still not much in the way of clothes, but she'd added a chair and a mirror, and the little dressing table was covered with moisturisers, hairbrushes and cosmetics that told me my sister might have changed beyond recognition, even in the few short months I had been gone. The only thing that told me it was Trina's room was the bedside reading, Tolly's capital allowances and an introduction to payroll. I knew I was overtired, but I felt wrong-footed all the same. Was this how Sam had felt when he flew out and saw me the second time? Had I seemed familiar and unfamiliar at the same time? My eyes were gritty with exhaustion, my internal clock haywire. There were still 3 hours before they'd get home. I washed my face, took off my shoes, and lay down on the sofa with a sigh, the sound of London traffic slowly receding. I woke to a sticky hand patting my cheek. I blinked, trying to bat it away, but there was a weight on my chest. It moved. A hand patted me again. And then I opened my eyes and found myself staring into Tom's. "Auntie Lou! Auntie Lou!" I groaned. "Hey, Tom. What did you get me?" "Let her at least open her eyes first." "You're on my boob, Tom. Ow!" Released, I pushed myself upright and blinked at my nephew, who was now bouncing up and down. "What did you get me?" My sister stooped and kissed my cheek, leaving one hand on my shoulder, which she squeezed. She smelt of expensive perfume, and I pulled back slightly to see her better. She was wearing makeup. Proper makeup. Subtly blended, rather than the one blue eyeliner she had received free with a magazine in 1994 and kept in a desk drawer to be used on every dressing-up occasion for the next 10 years. "You made it, then? Didn't get the wrong plane and end up in Caracas? Me and Dad had a bit of a bet on." "Cheek!" I reached up and held her hand for a moment longer than either of us had expected. "Wow, you look pretty." She did. She had her hair trimmed to shoulder length, and it hung in blow-dried waves rather than the usual scraped-back ponytail. That, the well-cut shirt, and the mascara actually made her look beautiful. "Well, it's work, really. You have to make an effort in the city." She turned away as she said this, so I didn't believe her. "I think I need to meet this Eddie," I said. "He's plainly having more of an effect on you than I ever did." She filled the kettle and switched it on,
That's because you only ever dressed like someone gave you a £2 voucher for a jumble sale, and you decided to blow the lot. It was growing dark outside. My jet-lagged brain suddenly registered what this meant.
Oh, wow. What time is it?
Time you gave me my presents!
Tom's gappy smile swam in front of me, both hands raised in prayer.
You're fine, said Trina. You've got another hour before Sam finishes. Plenty of time. Tom, Lou will give you whatever she's got once she's had a cup of tea and found her deodorant.
Also, what the bloody hell is that stripy coat thing you dropped in the hall? It smells like old fish.
Now I was home.
Okay, Tom, I said. There may be some pre-Christmas bits for you in that blue bag. Bring it over here. It took a shower and fresh makeup before I felt human again. I put on a silver miniskirt, a black polo neck and suede wedge-heeled shoes I had bought at the clothes emporium, Mrs. DeWitt's Bieber scarf and a spritz of Le Chasse au Papillon, the perfume Will had convinced me to buy, which always gave me confidence. Tom and Trina were eating when I was ready to leave. She had offered me some pasta with cheese and tomato, but my stomach had started to work its way into knots and my body clock was screwed up.
I like that thing you've done with your eyes. Very seductive, I said to her. She pulled a face.
Are you going to be okay to drive? You plainly can't see properly.
It's not far. I've had a power nap.
And when will we expect you home? This new sofa bed is bloody amazing, in case you're wondering. Proper sprung mattress. None of your 2 inches of foam rubbish.
I'm hoping I won't need to use the sofa bed for a day or two. I gave her a cheesy smile.
What's that? Tom swallowed his mouthful and pointed at the parcel under my arm.
Ah, that's a Christmas stocking. Sam's working on Christmas Day and I won't see him till the evening, so I thought I'd give him something to wake up with.
Don't ask to see what's in there, Tom.
There's nothing in it that I couldn't give to Grandad. It's just a bit of fun. She actually winked at me.
I offered silent thanks to Eddie and his miracle-working ways.
Text me later, yeah, just so I know whether to put the train on.
I kissed them both and headed for the door.
Don't put him off with your terrible half-assed American accent.
I held up a middle finger as I exited the flat.
And don't forget to drive on the left. And don't wear that coat that smells like mackerel.
I heard her laughing as I shut the door. For the past 3 months, I had either walked, hailed a taxi, or been chauffeured by Gary in the huge black limousine. Getting used to being behind the wheel of my little hatchback with its dodgy clutch and biscuit crumbs in the passenger seat took a surprising amount of concentration. I set out into the last of the evening rush hour traffic, put the radio on, and tried to ignore the hammering in my chest, not sure whether it was the fear of driving or the prospect of seeing Sam again. The sky was dark, the streets thick with shoppers and strung with Christmas lights, and my shoulders dropped slowly from somewhere around my ears as I braked and lurched my way to the suburbs. The pavements became verges, and the crowds thinned and disappeared, just the odd person glimpsed instead through brightly lit windows as I passed. And then, shortly after 8, I slowed to a crawl, peering forward over the wheel to make sure I had the right place in the unlit lane. The railway carriage sat glowing in the middle of the dark field, casting a golden light out through its windows onto the mud and grass. I could just make out his motorbike on the far side of the gate, tucked into its little shed behind the hedge. He had even put a little spray of Christmas lights in the hawthorn at the front. He really was home. I pulled the car into the passing place, cut the lights and looked at it. Then, almost as an afterthought, I picked up my phone.
"Really looking forward to seeing you," I typed.
"Not long now."
Kiss, kiss, kiss.
There was a short pause, and then the response pinged back.
"Me too.
Safe flight."
Kiss, kiss.
I grinned. Then I climbed out, realizing too late I had parked over a puddle, so the cold, muddy water washed straight over my shoes.
"Oh, thanks, universe," I whispered.
"Nice touch." I placed my carefully purchased Santa hat on my head and pulled his stocking from the passenger seat, then shut the door softly, locking it manually so that it didn't beep and alert him to the fact that I was there. My feet squelched as I tiptoed forward, and I recalled the first time I had come here, how I had been soaked by a sudden shower and ended up in his clothes, my own steaming in the fuggy little bathroom as they dried. That had been an extraordinary night, as if he had peeled off all the layers that Will's death had built up around me. I had a sudden flashback to our first kiss, to the feel of his huge socks soft on my chilled feet, and a hot shiver ran through me. I opened the gate, noting with relief that he had made a rudimentary path of paving slabs over to the railway carriage since I had last been there. A car drove past, and in the brief illumination of its headlights, I glimpsed Sam's partially built house ahead of me. Its roof now on, and windows already fitted. Where one was still missing, blue tarpaulin flapped gently over the gap so that it seemed suddenly, startlingly, a real thing, a place we might one day live. I tiptoed a few more paces, then paused just outside the door. The smell of something wafted out of an open window, a casserole of some sort, rich and tomato-y with a hint of garlic. I felt unexpectedly hungry. Sam never ate packet noodles or beans out of a tin. Everything was made from scratch, as if he drew pleasure from doing things methodically. Then I saw him, his uniform still on, the tea towel slung over his shoulder as he stooped to see to a pan. And just for a moment I stood, unseen in the dark, and felt utterly calm. I heard the distant breeze in the trees, the soft cluck of the hens locked nearby in their coop, the distant hum of traffic headed towards the city. I felt the cool air against my skin, and the tang of Christmassy anticipation in the air I breathed. Everything was possible. That was what I had learnt these last few months. Life might have been complicated, but ultimately there was just me and the man I loved in his railway carriage, and the prospect of a joyous evening ahead. I took a breath, letting myself savour that thought, stepped forward, and put my hand on the door handle. And then I saw her. She walked across the carriage saying something unclear, her voice muffled by the glass, her hair clipped up and tumbling in soft curls around her face. She was wearing a man's T-shirt, his, and holding a bottle of wine, and I saw him shake his head. And then as he bent over the stove, she walked up behind him and placed her hands on his neck, leaning towards him and rubbing the muscles around it with small, circular motions of her thumbs, a movement that seemed born of familiarity. Her thumbnails were painted deep pink. As I stood there, my breath stalled in my chest. He leant his head back, his eyes closed, as if surrendering himself to her fierce little hands. And then he turned to face her, smiling, his head tilted to one side, and she stepped back laughing and raised a glass to him. I didn't see anything else. My heart thumped so loudly in my ears that I thought I might pass out. I stumbled backwards, then turned and ran back down the path, my breath too loud, my feet icy in my wet shoes. Even though my car was probably 50 yards away, I heard her sudden burst of laughter echo through the open window, like a glass shattering. I sat in my car in the car park behind my building until I could be sure Tom had gone to bed. I couldn't hide what I felt, and I couldn't bear to explain it to Trina in front of him. I glanced up periodically, watching as his bedroom light went on, and then, half an hour later, went off again. I turned off the engine and let it tick down. As it faded, so did every dream I had been clinging on to. I shouldn't have been surprised. Why would I? Katie Ingram had laid her cards on the table from the start. What had shocked me was that Sam had been complicit. He hadn't shrugged her off. He had answered me, and then he had cooked her a meal and let her rub his neck, and it was preparation for... what? Every time I pictured them, I found myself clutching my stomach doubled over as if I'd been punched. I couldn't shake the image of them from my head. The way he tilted his head back at the pressure of her fingers. The way she had laughed confidently, teasingly, as if at some shared joke between them. The strangest thing was that I couldn't cry. What I felt was bigger than grief. I was numb, my brain humming with questions. How long? How far? Why? And then I would find myself doubled over again, wanting to be sick with it. This new knowledge, this hefty blow, this pain, this pain, this pain. I'm not sure how long I sat there, but around 10 I walked slowly upstairs and let myself into the flat. I was hoping Trina had gone to bed, but she was in her pyjamas watching the news, her laptop on her knee. She was smiling at something on her screen and jumped when I opened the door. "Jesus, you nearly frightened the life out of me!" "Lou?" She pushed her laptop to one side. "Lou?" "Oh, no." "It's always the kindnesses that finish you off. My sister, A woman who found adult physical contact more discomforting than dental treatment put her arms around me, and from some unexpected place that felt like it was located in the deepest part of me, I began to sob, huge, breathless, knotty tears. I cried in a way I hadn't cried since Will had died, sobs that contained the death of dreams and the dread knowledge of months of heartbreak ahead. We slowly sank down onto the sofa, and I buried my head in her shoulder and held her. And this time my sister rested her head against mine, and she held me and didn't let me go. Chapter 18. Neither Sam nor my parents had expected to see me, so for the next 2 days it was easy to hide in the flat and pretend I wasn't there. I wasn't ready to see anyone. I wasn't ready to speak to anyone. When Sam texted, I ignored it, reasoning that he would believe I was running around like a headless chicken back in New York. I found myself gazing repeatedly at his two messages. What do you fancy doing Christmas Eve? Church service or too tired? And, are we seeing each other Boxing Day? And I would marvel that this man, this most straightforward and honourable of men, had acquired such a blatant ability to lie to me. For those 2 days I painted on a smile while Tom was in the flat, folding away the sofa bed as he chatted over breakfast and disappearing into the shower. The moment he had gone, I would return to the sofa and lie there, gazing up at the ceiling, tears trickling from the corners of my eyes, or coldly mulling over the many ways I appeared to have got it all wrong. Had I leapt headfirst into a relationship with Sam because I was still grieving Will? Had I ever really known him at all? We see what we want to see, after all, especially when blinded by physical attraction. Had he done what he did because of Josh? Because of Agnes's pregnancy test? Did there even have to be a reason? I no longer trusted my own judgment enough to tell. For once, Trina didn't badger me to get up or do something constructive. She shook her head, disbelieving, and cursed Sam out of Tom's earshot. Even in the depths of my misery, I was left mulling over Eddie's apparent ability to instill in my sister something resembling empathy. She didn't once say it wasn't a huge surprise, given I was living so many thousands of miles away, or that I must have done something to push him into Katie Ingram's arms, or that any of this was inevitable. She listened when I told her the events that had led up to that night. She made sure I ate, washed, and got dressed. And although she wasn't much of a drinker, she brought home 2 bottles of wine, and said she thought I was allowed a couple of days of wallowing, but added that if I was sick, I had to clear it up myself. By the time Christmas Eve arrived, I had grown a hard shell, a carapace. I felt like an ice statue. At some point, I realized I was going to have to speak to him, but I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't sure I ever would be. "What will you do?" said Trina, sitting on the loo while I had a bath. She wasn't seeing Eddie until Christmas Day and was painting her toenails a pale pink in preparation, although she wouldn't admit as much. Out in the living room, Tom had the television turned up to deafening volume and was leaping on and off the sofa in a pre-Christmas frenzy. I was thinking I might just tell him I missed the flight and that we'd speak after Christmas. She pulled a face. "You don't just want to speak to him. He's not going to believe that." "I don't really care what he believes right now. I just want to have Christmas with my family and no drama." I sank under the water so that I couldn't hear Trina shouting at Tom to turn the sound down. He didn't believe me. His text message said, "What? How could you miss the flight?" "I just did," I typed. "I'll see you Boxing Day." I observed too late I hadn't put any kisses on it. There was a long silence and then a single word in response. "Okay." Trina drove us to Stortford, Tom bouncing in the rear seat for the full hour and a half it took us to get there. We listened to Christmas carols on the radio and spoke little. We were a mile out of town when I thanked her for her consideration, and she whispered that it wasn't for me. Eddie hadn't actually met Mum and Dad either, so she was feeling nauseous at the thought of Christmas Day. "It'll be fine," I told her. The smile she flashed me wasn't very convincing. "Come on. They like that accountant bloke you dated earlier this year. And to be honest, Trina, you've been single so long,
I think you could probably bring home anyone who wasn't Attila the Hun right now, and they'd be delighted.
Well, that theory's about to be tested.
We pulled up before I could say any more, and I checked my eyes, which were still pea-sized from the amount of crying I'd done, and climbed out of the car. My mother burst out of the front door and ran down the path like a sprinter off the starting blocks. She threw her arms around me, holding me so tightly I could feel our heart thumping.
"Look at you!" she exclaimed, holding me at arm's length before pulling me in again.
She pushed a lock of hair from my face and turned to my father, who stood on the step, his arms crossed, beaming.
"How wonderful you look! Bernard, see how grand she looks!
Oh, we've missed you so much! Have you lost weight? You look like you've lost weight. You look tired. You need to eat something. Come indoors.
I'll bet they didn't give you breakfast on that plane. I've heard it's all powdered egg anyhow."
She hugged Tom, and before my father could step forward, she grabbed my bags and marched back up the path, beckoning us all to follow.
"Hello, sweetheart," said Dad, softly, and I stepped into his arms.
As they closed around me, I finally allowed myself to exhale. Granddad hadn't made it as far as the step. He had had another small stroke, Mum whispered, and now had trouble standing up or walking, so spent most of his daylight hours in the upright chair in the living room.
"We didn't want to worry you."
He was dressed smartly in a shirt and pullover, in honour of the occasion, and smiled lopsidedly when I walked in. He held up a shaking hand and I hugged him, noting with some distant part of me how much smaller he seemed. But then everything seemed smaller. My parents' house with its 20-year-old wallpaper, its artwork chosen less for aesthetic reasons than because it had been given by someone nice or covered certain dents in the wall. Its sagging 3-piece suite, its tiny dining area where the chairs hit the wall if you pushed them back too far. And a ceiling light that started only a few inches above my father's head. I found myself comparing it distantly to the grand apartment with its acres of polished floors, its huge ornate ceilings, the clamorous sweep of Manhattan outside our door. I had thought I might feel comforted at being home. Instead, I felt untethered, as if suddenly it occurred to me that, at the moment, I actually belonged in neither place. We ate a light supper of roast beef, potatoes, Yorkshire puddings and trifle, just a little something Mum had knocked together before tomorrow's main event. Dad was keeping the turkey in the shed, as it wouldn't fit in the fridge, and went out to check every half an hour that it hadn't fallen into the clutches of Houdini, next door's cat. Mum gave us a rundown on the various tragedies that had befallen our neighbours. Well, of course, that was before Andrew's shingles. He showed me his stomach, put me quite off my Weetabix, and I've told Dimpfner she needs to put those feet up before the baby's born. Honestly, her varicose veins are like a B-road map of the Chilterns. Did I tell you Mrs. Kemp's father died? He's the one did 4 years for armed robbery before they discovered it had been that bloke from the post office who had the same hair plugs. Mum rattled on. It was only when she was clearing the plates that Dad leant over to me and said,
"Would you believe she's nervous?"
"Nervous of what?"
"You. All your achievements. She was half afraid you wouldn't want to come back here, that you'd spend Christmas with your fella and head straight back to New York."
"Why would I want to do that?"
He shrugged. "I don't know. She thought you might have outgrown us. I told her she was being daft. Don't take that the wrong way, love. She's bloody proud of you. She prints out all your pictures and puts them in a scrapbook and bores the neighbours rigid showing them off. To be honest, she bores me rigid and I'm related to you."
He grinned and squeezed my shoulder. I felt briefly ashamed at how much time I'd intended spending at Sam's. I'd planned to leave Mum to handle all the Christmas stuff, my family and Grandad like I always did. I left Trina and Tom with Dad and took the rest of the plates through to the kitchen, where Mum and I washed up in companionable silence for a while. She turned to me.
"You do look tired, love. Have you the jet lag?"
"A bit."
"You sit down with the others. I'll take care of this."
I forced my shoulders back.
"No, Mum, I haven't seen you for months. Why don't you tell me what's going on? How's your night school? And what's the doctor saying about Grandad?"
The evening stretched and the television burbled in the corner of the room, and the temperature rose until we were all semi-comatose and cradling our bellies, like someone heavily pregnant, in the way one did after one of my mother's light suppers. The thought that we would do this again tomorrow made my stomach turn gently in protest. Grandad dozed in the chair, and we left him there while we went to midnight mass. I stood in the church, surrounded by people whom I had known since I was small,
nudging and smiling at me, and I sang the carols I remembered and mouthed the ones I didn't, and tried not to think about what Sam was doing at that exact moment, as I did approximately 118 times a day. Occasionally, Trina would catch my eye from along the pew and give me a small encouraging smile, and I gave one back, as if to say, "I'm fine. All good." Even though I wasn't, and nothing was. It was a relief to peel off to the box room when we got back. Perhaps it was because I was in my childhood home, or I was exhausted from 3 days of high emotion. But I slept soundly, for the first time since I had arrived in England. I was dimly aware of Trina being woken at 5 a.m. and some excited thudding, then Dad yelling at Tom that it was still the middle of the ruddy night, and if he didn't go back to bed, he would tell Father Ruddy Christmas to come and take all the ruddy presents back again. The next time I woke, Mum was putting a mug of tea on my bedside table and telling me that if I could get dressed, we were about to start opening the presents. It was 11:15. I picked up the little clock, squinted and shook it. "You needed it," she said, stroked my head, then went off to see to the sprouts. I descended 20 minutes later in the comedy reindeer jumper with the illuminated nose I had bought in Macy's because I knew Tom would enjoy it. Everyone else was already down, dressed and breakfasted. I kissed them all and wished them a happy Christmas, turned my reindeer nose on and off, then distributed my own gifts, all the while trying not to think of the man who should have been the recipient of a cashmere sweater and a really soft checked flannel shirt, which were languishing at the bottom of my case. I wouldn't think about him today, I told myself firmly. Time with my family was precious, and I wouldn't ruin it by feeling sad. My gifts went down a treat, apparently given an extra layer of desirability by having come from New York, even if I was pretty sure you could have got pretty much the same things from Argos. "All the way from New York?" Mum would say in awe after every item was unwrapped, until Trina rolled her eyes and Tom started mimicking her. Of course, the gift that went down best was the cheapest, a plastic snow globe I had bought at a tourist stall in Times Square. I was pretty sure it would be leaking quietly into Tom's chest of drawers before the week was out. In return, I received socks from Grandad, 99% sure these had been chosen and bought by Mum, soaps from Dad, ditto, a small silver frame with a picture of our family already fitted into it. "So you can take us with you wherever you go, Mum." "Dad, why the heck would you want to do that? She went to ruddy New York to get away from us all." A device that removed nostril hair from Trina. "Don't look at me like that. You're getting to that age." A picture of a Christmas tree with a poem underneath it from Tom. On close questioning, it turned out he hadn't actually made it himself. "Our teacher says we don't stick the decorations on the right places, so she does them and we just put our names on them." I received a gift from Lily, dropped in the previous day before she and Mrs. Trainer went skiing. "She looks well, Lou, though she runs Mrs. Trainer pretty ragged from what I've heard." A vintage ring, a huge green stone in a silver setting that fitted perfectly on my little finger. I had sent her a pair of silver earrings that looked like cuffs, assured by the fearsomely trendy Soho shop assistant that they were perfect for a teenage girl, especially one now apparently prone to piercings in unexpected places. I thanked everyone and watched Grandad nod off. I smiled, and I think I put on a pretty good impression of someone who was enjoying the day. Mum was smarter than that. "Is everything okay, love? You seem very flat." She ladled goose fat over the potatoes and stepped back as it sprayed out in an angry mist. "Oh, will you look at those? They're going to be lovely and crisp." "I'm fine." "Is it the jet lag still?" "Ronnie, from three doors down, said when he went to Florida, it took him 3 weeks to stop walking into walls." "That's pretty much it." "Can't believe I have a daughter who gets jet lag. I'm the envy of everyone at the club, you know." I looked up. "You've been there again?" After Will had ended his life, my parents had been ostracized at the social club they'd belonged to for years, blamed vicariously for my actions in going along with his plan. It was one of the many things that I had felt guilty about. "Well, that Marjorie has moved to Cirencester. You know, she was the worst for the gossip. And then Stuart from the garage told Dad he should come down and have a game of pool sometime, just casual-like. And it was all fine." She shrugged. "And you know, all that business was a couple of years ago now. People have other things to think about." People have other things to think about. I don't know why that innocent statement caught me by the throat, but it did. As I was trying to swallow a sudden wave of grief, Mum shoved the tray of potatoes back into the oven.
She shut the door with a satisfied clunk, then turned to me, pulling the oven gloves from her hands.
I almost forgot the strangest thing. Your man called this morning to say, what were we going to do about your flight Boxing Day, and did we mind if he picked you up himself?
I froze.
What?
She lifted a lid on a pan, released a burp of steam, and put it down again.
Well, I told him he must have been mistaken, and you were here already, so he said he'd pop over later. Honestly, the shifts must be taking it out of him. I heard a thing on the radio where they said working nights can be awful bad for your brain. You might want to tell him.
What? When's he coming? Mum glanced at the clock.
I think he said he was finishing mid-afternoon and he'd head over afterwards. All that way on Christmas Day. Here, have you met Trina's fella yet? Have you noticed the way she's dressing these days?
She glanced behind her at the door and her voice was full of wonder.
It's almost like she's becoming a normal person.
I sat through Christmas lunch on high alert, outwardly calm but flinching every time someone passed our door. Every bite of my mother's cooking turned to powder in my mouth. Every bad cracker joke my father read out went straight over my head. I couldn't eat, couldn't hear, couldn't feel. I was locked in a bell jar of miserable anticipation. I glanced at Trina, but she seemed preoccupied too, and I realized she was waiting on Eddie's arrival. How hard could it be? I thought grimly. At least her boyfriend wasn't cheating on her. At least he wanted to be with her. It began to rain, and the drops spat meanly on the windows, the sky darkening to fit my mood. Our little house, strung with tinsel and glitter-strewn greeting cards, shrank around us, and I felt alternately as if I couldn't breathe in it, and terrified of anything that lay beyond it. Occasionally I saw Mum's eyes slide towards me, as if she was wondering what was going on, but she didn't say anything, and I didn't volunteer it. I helped clear the dishes and chatted. I thought convincingly about the joys of grocery delivery in New York, and finally the doorbell went and my legs turned to jelly. Mum turned to look at me.
Are you okay, Louisa? You've gone quite pale.
I'll tell you later, Mum. My mother stared at me hard, then her face softened.
I'll be here.
She reached out and tucked a strand of hair behind my ear. Whatever this is all about, I'll be here. Sam stood on the front step in a soft cobalt jumper I hadn't seen before. I wondered who had given it to him. He gave me a half smile but didn't stoop to kiss me or throw his arms around me like in our previous meetings. We gazed warily at each other. Do you want to come in? My voice sounded oddly formal. Thanks. I walked in front of him down the narrow corridor, waited while he greeted my parents through the living room door, then led him into the kitchen, closing the door behind us. I felt acutely aware of his presence, as if we were both mildly electrified.
Would you like some tea?
Sure. Nice jumper.
Oh, thanks.
You've left your nose on.
Right.
I reached down and turned it off, not willing to indulge anything that might soften the mood between us. He sat down at the table, his body somehow too big for our kitchen chairs, his eyes still on me, and clasped his hands on its surface. Like someone awaiting a job interview. In the living room I could hear Dad laughing at some film, and Tom's shrill voice demanding to know what was funny. I busied myself making tea, but I could feel his eyes burning into my back the whole time.
So,
Sam said when I handed him a mug and sat down.
You're here.
I nearly buckled then. I looked across the table at his handsome face, at the broad shoulders and the hands wrapped gently around the mug, and a thought popped into my head. I cannot bear it if he leaves me. But then I found myself standing again on that chilly step, her slim fingers on his neck, my feet icy in my wet shoes, and I grew cold again. I got back 2 days ago, I said. The briefest of pauses.
Okay.
I thought I'd come and surprise you Thursday evening. I scratched at a mark on the tablecloth. Turns out it was me who got the surprise. I watched realization dawn slowly across his face, his slight frown, his eyes growing distant, then their faint closure when he grasped what I might have seen.
Lou, I don't know what you saw, but...
But what? It's not what you think.
Well, it is, and it isn't.
It was like a punch. Let's not do this, Sam. He looked up. I'm pretty clear about what I saw. If you try and convince me it wasn't what I think, I'll want to believe you so badly that I might actually do it. And what I've realised these last 2 days is that this isn't good for me. It isn't good for either of us. Sam put his mug down. He dragged his hand over his face and looked off to the side. I don't love her, Lou. I don't really care what you feel about her. But I want you to know. Yes, you were right about Katie. I may have misread the signals. She does like me. I let out a bitter laugh. And you like her. I don't know what I think about her. But you're the person who's in my head. You're the person I wake up thinking about. But the thing is, you're not here. Don't you blame this on me. Don't you dare blame this on me. You told me to go. You told me to go. We sat in silence for a few moments. I found myself staring at his hands. The strong, battered knuckles. The way they looked so hard, so powerful, but were capable of such tenderness. I stared determinedly at the mark on the cloth. You know, Lou, I thought I'd be fine by myself. I've been on my own a long time, after all. But you cracked something open in me. Oh, so it's my fault. I'm not saying that, he burst out. I'm trying to explain. I'm saying I'm no longer as good at being on my own as I thought I was. After my sister died, I didn't want to feel anything for anyone again, okay? I had room to care for Jake, but nobody else. I had my job and my half-built house and my chickens, and that was fine. I was just getting on with it all. And then you came along and fell off that bloody building, and literally the first time you held onto my hand, I felt something given me. And suddenly I had someone I looked forward to talking to. Someone who understood how I felt. Really, really understood. I could drive past your flat and know that at the end of a crap day, I was going to be able to call up to you or pop in later and feel better. And yes, I know we had some issues, but it just felt deep down, like there was something right in there. You know? His head was bowed over his tea, his jaw clenched. And then, just as we were close, closer than I've ever felt to another living soul, you were just gone. And I felt like someone had given me this gift, this key to everything with one hand, then snatched it away with the other. Then why did you let me go? His voice exploded into the room. Because I'm not that man, Lou. I'm not the man who's going to insist that you stay. I'm not the man who's going to stop you having the adventures and growing and doing all the stuff that you're doing out there. I'm not that guy. No. You're the guy who hooks up with someone else as soon as I've gone. Someone in the same zip code. It's a postcode. You're in England, for Christ's sake. Yep, and you have no idea how much I wish I wasn't. Sam turned away from me, clearly struggling to contain himself. Beyond the kitchen doors, although the television was still on, I was dimly aware of the silence in the front room. After a few minutes, I said quietly, I can't do this, Sam. You can't do what? I can't be worrying about Katie Ingram and her attempts to seduce you, because whatever happened that night, I could see what she wanted, even if I don't know what you wanted. It's making me crazy, and it's making me sad, and worse. I swallowed hard. It's making me hate you, and I can't imagine how, in 3 short months, I've got to that point. Louisa. There was a discreet knock at the door. My mother's face appeared. Sorry to disturb you both, but would you mind very much if I quickly made some tea? Grandpa's gasping. Sure. I kept my face turned away. She bustled in and filled the kettle, her back to us. They're watching some film about aliens. It's not very Christmassy. I remember when Christmas Day was all Wizard of Oz or The Sound of Music or something that everyone could watch together. Now they're watching all this whiz-bam shooting nonsense and Grandad and I can't understand a word anyone's saying. My mother rattled on, plainly mortified at having to be there, tapping the work surface with her fingers as she waited for the kettle to boil. You know, we haven't even watched the Queen's speech. Daddy put it on the old recording box thing, but it's not the same if you watch it afterwards, is it? I like to watch it when everyone else is watching it. The poor old woman wedged in all those video boxes until everyone's finished the aliens and the cartoons. You'd think after 60 years of service. How long has she been on that throne? Well, the least we could do is watch her do her thing when she does it.
Mind you, Daddy tells me I'm being ridiculous, as she probably recorded it weeks ago. Sam, will you have some cake?
Not for me, thanks, Josie.
Lou?
No thanks, Mum.
I'll leave you to it.
She smiled awkwardly, loaded a fruitcake the size of a tractor wheel onto the tray and hurried out. Sam got up and closed the door behind her. We sat in silence, listening to the kitchen clock ticking, the air laden. I felt crushed under the weight of the things unsaid between us. Sam took a long swig of his tea. I wanted him to leave. I thought I might die if he did. I'm sorry, he said finally, about the other night. I never wanted to... Well, it was badly judged. I shook my head. I couldn't speak any more. I didn't sleep with her. If you won't hear anything else, I do need you to hear that. You said... He looked up. You said nobody would ever hurt me again. You said that when you came to New York. My voice emerged from somewhere in my chest. I never thought for a moment you would be the one to do it. Louisa. I think I'd like you to go now. He stood heavily and hesitated, both hands on the table in front of him. I couldn't look at him. I couldn't see the face I loved about to disappear from my life forever. He straightened up, let out an audible breath, and turned away from me. He pulled a package from his inside pocket and placed it on the table. Merry Christmas, he said. And he walked to the door. I followed him back down the corridor, 11 long steps, and then we were on the front porch. I couldn't look at him or I would be lost. I would plead with him to stay, promise to give up his job, beg him to change his job, not to see Katie Ingram again. I would become pathetic, the kind of woman I pitied, the kind of woman he had never wanted. I stood, my shoulders rigid, and I refused to look any further than his stupid, oversized feet. A car pulled up, a door slammed somewhere down the street, birds sang, and I stood, locked in my own private misery, in a moment that stubbornly refused to end. And then, abruptly, he stepped forward and his arms closed around me. He pulled me to him, and in that embrace I felt everything that we had meant to each other, the love and the pain and the bloody impossibility of it all, and my face, unseen by him, crumpled. I don't know how long we stood there, probably only seconds, but time briefly stopped, stretched, disappeared. It was just him and me and this awful dead feeling creeping from my head to my feet, as if I were turning to stone. Don't touch me, I said when I couldn't bear it any more. My voice was choked and unlike itself, and I pushed him back, away from me. Lou? Except it wasn't his voice, it was my sister's. Lou, could you just... Sorry, get out of the way, please. I need to get past. I blinked and turned my head. My sister, her...